Everyone for coming. My name is Ellie Hassenfeld. I'm one of GiveWell's co-founders. The basic plan for tonight is that I'm first going to talk for a while about GiveWell's traditional work on top charities. That'll cover about the first hour. Then we're going to break for a few minutes, and then Holden Karnofsky, GiveWell's other co-founder, is going to come and talk about the Open Philanthropy Project. In this hour, I'm going to talk for two relatively short periods of 10 minutes, and then open it up to you for questions on pretty much anything that you'd like to ask about, whether it's things that I explicitly covered or other questions that you have about GiveWell. You might notice that this recorder's here on the table. We're recording this, and I'm not sure whether or not we'll end up posting a recording on our website, but we may. If you say anything that you'd prefer not be posted, just shoot us an email to info@givewell.org after the event. We're happy to edit the recording. So feel free to talk freely here, and if you'd like us to edit it out, we're certainly happy to do so. I'm also going to try to offer information at the right level of background and detail for the audience that's here, but I know that we're going to miss the getting this right in some cases. So if there's any questions that you have because I skipped over helpful background information, you should totally feel free to ask those questions during the Q&A. Don't hold back at all, because I may have just misjudged the general background of the audience. In general, my guess is that the audience here is relatively familiar with our work, and so I'm going to skip going into like a lot of background. So without further ado, I'm going to dive in. So GiveWell's traditional work focuses on finding giving opportunities that we have high confidence have significant impact per dollar. And we're basically looking for organizations that do well on four major criteria. We want to be confident that they are effective, so we look for high quality evidence of effectiveness. That often means independent randomized controlled trials of an organization's work or the program that they implement. We're looking for charities that are cost-effective, so they, when we try to model it out, they have significant impact per dollar given. We try to assess organizations, what we call room for more funding, which is the whether the marginal funds that they take in, any additional money beyond what they had in the past, will also have significant impacts, as opposed to just assessing whether, say, the average impact of the money they've taken in the past has been high impact per dollar. And then finally, we're looking for organizations that are transparent. In many cases, that's a necessity, because a lot of information that would be necessary to assess charities is not already publicly available. But I think it's also a sign when an organization is more transparent and more willing to share both successes and failures that they're more likely to be effective in their work. We currently have four top charities. I'm not really going to go into much about each of them, but just to list them. The four are the Against Malaria Foundation, which we call AMF, and they fund distributions of malaria nets in Africa. GiveDirectly, which provides direct cash transfers of $1,000 to poor households in East Africa. And two organizations that work on deworming programs. Deworming is a program that is mass administration of a pill once or twice a year that kills parasitic infections that affect hundreds of millions of children in Africa. And these infections, some evidence suggests, have significant long-term effects on children's cognitive development. Cognitive and I guess other development. And these two organizations, one is the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, we call them SCI, and the other is the Deworm the World Initiative, which is part of a larger group called Evidence Action, but we recommend the Deworm the World Initiative. And we also have four other standout charities that I'm not gonna sort of go into the details about them right now. In all the cases of our four top charities, we've been following them closely so far in 2015, and so far there's not a lot of news from any of them. Mostly what we said at the end of last year remains true, and we continue to see all of them as outstanding giving opportunities, and we tend to work on an annual cycle because so much of charitable giving happens at the very end of the year in December, and so our sort of big refresh will happen in November. you know, totally happy to take questions about any of those organizations, but I'm not planning to dive in more into them right now. So the thing I kind of want to talk a little bit about in this section is an organization that's a potential top charity in the coming year. So this organization is currently a standout, which means we recommend them, but in a lower tier than our top charities. They're the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, or GAIN, and specifically their program to support salt iodization in the developing world. Salt iodization is the process of fortifying salt with iodine, and it's a program that significant evidence shows has a significant impact on cognitive development. So they, you know, actually ran randomized control trials where a certain group got the iodized salt and then another group did not, and they found that the group with iodized salt had IQ gains over the period of the study. And so this is a program. I should also add that it's the case that when people are significantly iodine deficient, as opposed to in these studies they were moderately iodine deficient, there's evidence that pregnant mothers who are significantly iodine deficient are more likely to have children who are significantly disabled. And so the condition, I think, is cretinism, that children who are born to iodine deficient mothers or severely iodine deficient mothers may have. And so I think there's a strong case that this program, when you take people from iodine deficiency to taking care of that and getting rid of that deficiency, has a significant impact on people's life outcomes. Now, GAIN is not trying to implement this program itself. The way that salt iodization program works is you have there's multiple players involved in bringing a country's level of iodization up to the appropriate level. Normally, there's a private set of salt producers that are just for-profit companies selling salt into the market. They need to incorporate iodization into their process. And then the government of a country is often involved in passing laws that require that salt is iodized and iodized to an appropriate level. And so GAIN is not an organization that is getting involved in directly iodizing salt. But what they do is advocate to the government, provide consulting essentially to the salt producers, and do other things to try and increase the coverage of iodized salt in a given country. GAIN is currently a standout, and we investigated them to some extent in 2014, and we basically did not, you can see the review that's currently on our website, we didn't have the time to get deep enough into the case studies that they shared with us to be confident that GAIN was having an impact on iodization in the countries in which they had been working. And so the goal of our investigation this year is to try and spend additional capacity on investigating GAIN to see whether or not we either become convinced that they're likely not having the impact they set out to, in which case we would no longer keep them, we would not recommend them, or if we can become convinced that they have the impact, move them to top charity status, which would result in significantly more donations to what they're doing. So what we've currently decided to do is focus on GAIN's activities in one country, in Ethiopia. It's a very large country. It's also one where iodization levels had been extremely low before GAIN went in. So I think in the latest survey that we have that's available, it's from the latest survey preceding GAIN's involvement in Ethiopia from 2005. The coverage of household salt was something like 15 to 20%, which is very low relative to other countries worldwide. Our understanding is that for a long time, GAIN was importing salt from Eritrea, and then due to some political instability in the region, was no longer able to do so, and then had to develop its own iodization capacity because it didn't have that before. So we've decided to focus on GAIN as a case study to see whether we can see impact there, because GAIN has told us that this is a country where they believe they've had significant impact. One claim that they've made is that in the most recent in a more recent nutrition survey from 2014, and the survey is not yet public, so we haven't been able to delve into the details of it, household coverage rates of salt now approach 80%. And so between 2005 and 2014, there's been this substantial change in the rates of iodization. Obviously the obvious question, aside from whether the salt iodization rates have grown so much, is whether gain played the crucial role in improving iodization. There's basically no debate that iodization is better than no iodization, and therefore, many other players are involved. Everyone knows that this is something that would be in Ethiopia's best interest as a country. So the main things that gain has told us, I think the three main types of impact that they may have had are the following. One is kind of very straightforward. In order to iodize salt, you require an iodization machine, and gain donated several of these machines to Ethiopia. And so the question that we have now is, to what extent are these machines in operation? Are they actually being used or not? And that's something where I think there is often, you might say there's little reason to be skeptical of a claim as basic as that, but I think the stories where equipment donated to Africa ends up falling into disrepair and unused are very common. And so it's certainly something that we want to see more evidence for than just a claim that the machines are being used. The second type of impact that Gain has described is doing quality assurance checks to ensure that the salt is actually iodized to the level that it's supposed to be. And so these checks might take the form of a truck traveling along the road in Ethiopia, and there's a random checkpoint where someone says, I want you, trucker, to take a random sample of salt off of your truck so we can test whether or not it's adequately iodized. The sort of summary level numbers we've seen from this type of check look very promising. High levels of salt are iodized. At the same time, we've only seen summary numbers that Gain has reported to us, and we don't yet have a full understanding of the frequency, the methodology, and the overall, the full comprehensive set of checks and data that has been performed. And then finally, Gain has talked to us about this structure that it really catalyzed, which is called a revolving fund, which was a mechanism for salt producers to purchase potassium iodate, which is the commodity that goes into salt to iodize it, and to enable these producers to purchase it without undue logistical burden. And so basically in Ethiopia, you have 100 salt producers, and before Gain came in with, or Gain tells us, with this revolving fund, producers either had salt donated, potassium iodate donated directly from UNICEF, in which case they used it, or they just didn't go out and purchase the salt on their own. And the argument that Gain has made to us is that it would be logistically impossible, or at least extremely difficult to the point where they wouldn't do it, for salt producers to go out and purchase potassium iodate on the global market. And so the revolving fund was the mechanism that enabled them to pay into a government fund, the government would purchase the iodate itself, and then dole it out to the producers, and each of these individual salt producers has a very clear mechanism for purchasing the commodity that it needs to iodize salt. So Gain has made the claim that it had played a significant role in change in iodization rates in Ethiopia. We actually currently have two staff members who are in Ethiopia, and they, they're trying to dig deeper into these questions. In some cases, we were told that the data that is available is government data, not Gain data, and that the only way we would be able to see it is by traveling and going into the Ministry of Health's office or the equivalent of the FDA's office in Ethiopia. And so they are there now, basically undertaking this task. I've been talking for about 15 minutes, so I want to pause here and kind of open up the floor for questions. I'm happy to talk about any of the follow-ups to things I just said, about Gain or anything else, but really anything else that relates to GiveWell that you have questions about. All the way in the back.
When you move something off the standout list into the top charity list, does something else get bumped in its place? If not, does the list get as big as you want of top charities?
Yeah, so I'm just going to repeat questions for the sake of the recording. So the question is, if we move something off the standout list to the top charity list, does something else get bumped to the standout list? we don't have a set number of slots that we're shooting for with either the top charities list or the standout list. It's more of a qualitative assessment of organizations that meet those two bars. So, you know, if everything stayed exactly the same and Gain convinced us they were having significant impact, then Gain would become a top charity and we would have three standouts instead of four. Yep.
You said you were interested in the degree to which Gain is responsible for the change in ionization. What other groups, if any, do you know about that might be playing a role?
Yeah, so the question is what groups other than Gain might be playing a role in ionization in Ethiopia? So there are a number of institutions that have been involved in Ethiopia, but in ionization efforts worldwide. So the main ones are UNICEF, which is this giant global health organization, global health and other development organization. They are involved in health programs in every country, and they've certainly been involved in ionization efforts specifically. Another organization is the Micronutrient Initiative. They're a organization based out of Canada, and you know they've similarly been involved in these efforts. And in both cases, so they've certainly been involved in Ethiopia because our staff members who are currently in Ethiopia have talked to representatives of both Micronutrient Initiative and UNICEF while they're there, and we've talked to representatives of those organizations in past investigations of salt and ionization. Finally, there's also a group called IGN, the Iodine Global Network, formerly known as ICC-IDD. You can see why they changed their name because their name used to be the International Council for the Control of Iodine Deficiency Disorders Global Network. So they shortened it to be better. So they're a very small organization. They're basically a network of mostly volunteer academics who are already working on nutrition and iodization related issues. And they will provide support to governments and advocacy as well. So those are the sort of non-profits involved. The other major players who could have played some significant role, one is the Gates Foundation. They provided a giant nutrition grant to many of the groups that I just mentioned in, I'd say, 2007, 2008. And this was called like the Partnership Project. And it provided significant support to Gain, among others. And you know, the work that Gain did in Ethiopia was funded by the Gates Foundation. And so, to some extent, there's a reasonable question of the role that or the causal impact that could be attributed to the Gates Foundation as opposed to the nonprofits. And then finally, there's the government of Ethiopia itself. I mean, this I think is a program that I would expect, like, they understand its benefits and it's in, you know, their interest to implement. And I think it's, like, not totally clear what would, if this would have happened with no outside involvement.
Could you talk a little about the amount of time, people, and resources have to be put in to get this level of knowledge about the situation and how much more you expect would be required to do the deep investigation you mentioned?
Yeah, so the question is how much time and resources go into this? You know, it's a really hard question to answer. You know, I think that right now we have something like 5 full-time staff members devoted to charity reviews. That might even be a slight overstatement. So let's say like 4 to 5 staff members on charity reviews, and they are able to put together the output that you see at the end of the year. And that consists of following up with past organizations that we've recommended, but also investigating new top charities. So I think like very roughly, like a few full-time person months is like roughly what's necessary to do a full review of a charity. I think what we had for Gain just in 2014 was substantially less than that, you know, on the order of a few person weeks. You know, a major caveat to all of that is that there's a big difference between staff who have been at GiveWell a very long time and have more context and thus are able to do more quickly than staff who are very new. And the vast majority of our staff right now, you know, 20, I'm going to get the overall numbers wrong, but you know, something like 20 out of 25 staff have been at GiveWell less than 2 years. And so we're still a very new staff. And so a lot of our capacity is devoted to training. And so it's a little hard to estimate what a steady state trained staff of charity reviewers looks like in terms of how quickly they can do that work. All the way in the back over here.
Yeah, follow-up question about the deep dives. So has the lack of churn in recommendations for top charities over the years caused any update in how valuable like additional resources into even deeper dives is?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, the question is, has the lack of churn caused us to update how valuable deeper dives really are? You know, I don't know. I think there's a question about, you know, I think our current top charities, you know, we've basically had bednets deworming and cash transfers for a couple of years now. I think to some extent, those are such outstanding giving opportunities that it is, you know, we may have just done a really good job finding the low-hanging fruit early on, and it's not entirely clear that we will be able to find other opportunities that end up being competitive with those long-term. You know, that said, I'm optimistic for a few reasons. One, I think that we've had a lot of challenges engaging with gain, for example. But, you know, if we complete our visit to Ethiopia and are confident that they're having an impact, then, you know, all of a sudden gain becomes another top charity that goes on the list. It's a program that I think is at least, salt iodization is at least competitive with the programs of other top charities. And at the sort of human capacity that would be required to find that new top charity seems worth the benefit in additional room for more funding. There are also like other organizations out there that seem like they could be as good as or significantly better than the charities we have now. So another standout that I didn't talk about at all is Development Media International, or DMI. And they're a group that runs mass media programs to encourage improved health behavior. So they might run a radio program that encourages parents to treat their children for malaria when they exhibit a fever, because that is, the earlier they get treatment, the more likely that their life will be saved. This is a program that, I mean, you can read the full review on our website, and they are currently conducting a trial that is ongoing. But, you know, if they do have the types of impacts on mortality that they expect to, that they hope to, you know, our best guess is that they're 5 times as cost effective as our top charities, you know, if they get those results. Now, you know, what our current estimate has is like some degree of adjustment for the fact that we're not sure they will actually get those results, but if they do, they'd be extremely cost effective. And so we want to, you know, deep dive them for that opportunity. Yeah, you have a follow-up?
Actually I have a specific question with regard to that variability question. So is there like a discount on like high variance potential high variance interventions due to like donor perception or public perception of high variance?
So the question is if there's a discount with high variance interventions due to donor perception. So to some extent, you know, GiveWell, as distinct from open philanthropy, is a project that puts more weight on higher confidence of impact than pure expected value of impact. And so, you know, we are looking for things that meet some bar for likelihood that they actually work. And that's a big part of our process, looking for evidence of effectiveness. Even that though is anyhow, that it becomes a complicated issue because in no way are our top charities sure things. I mean, there are significant questions about the impact that all of them have. Donor perception doesn't play an issue. Now, you know, you obviously are just taking my word for it, or maybe you're not. I know that I can't prove that to you. But, you know, we see our mission as finding the best giving opportunities and then finding a way to share that and not letting donor perception drive the research process. Right here.
If you were to add another top-level charity, is that going to dilute the impact of the other charities?
So if we add another charity, would it dilute the impact? I mean, I think that if we add another charity on expectation, it reduces the amount of funding that any individual charity will receive. We're still, that said, I mean, we're at the point now where we're more worried about, at least with some of the organizations, moving them more money than they can use effectively than we are not moving them enough so that they can use it productively. And so last year, our 4 top charities collectively received about $28 million. And so in a couple of cases, I mean, these were substantial amounts that let them, you know, use that money for very effective uses. And the bigger thing that I'm concerned about is finding more outstanding opportunities for what I hope is continued growth in the amount of money we influence, rather than being worried that the money we influence will be so small that charities will be divvying up a relatively small pot. Right here.
So isn't, like, previously Good Ventures is, like, meticulously maxed out the room for more funding? Like, not quite with that being the cause and effect. So wouldn't Good Ventures be able to increase its giving if you had another stand-up charity just to make it match?
So the question is you know, hasn't Good Ventures maxed out the room for more funding in the past? So it's a good question. It's not actually the case. There has always been a substantial amount of additional room for more funding for our top charities, and that remains the case right now. Last year Good Ventures gave about $14 million to our top charities, and we felt that that maxed out, Good Ventures gifts plus the gifts from our audience as a whole maxed out the room for more funding for the two deworming organizations. But both AMF, the malaria organization, and Give Directly, the cash transfers organization, have had and still have significant room for more funding. Yep.
This is a more abstract, hypothetical question, but have you thought about the effect of recommending sets of two or more charities where you think that increased donations to both of them would have some synergistic effect in combination, like maybe some kind of malaria net production and malaria net distribution charity where you get some benefit by helping both of them?
Yeah, so the question is whether we've thought about sort of like recommending tandem recommendations where like one is good, assuming the other gets money as well. I mean, we definitely would consider that. In practice, it hasn't come up. The way that the closest thing to this is, certainly if a group came to us and said, we can do X, but only if, this other group has money or we have the money to do something, that would affect our assessment of how much money they would need to receive to be effective. We've also thought about, and this is something I'll talk about in a few minutes, other things we can do to increase the number of GiveWell top charities. And so one possible activity is funding monitoring or the collection of additional monitoring or the conducting additional research that could be used to support the case for a program a charity runs or a charity itself. Yep, right here.
You guys ever thought about like funding some sort of X Prize for charities so you can have them compete and see?
Have we ever thought about like an X Prize for charities? I mean, we sort of hope like GiveWell's recommendation itself is like that for the type of charity we're looking for.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it is that way right now. I mean, if you run a BedNet charity, BedNets are a program that is just extremely effective, has great cost effectiveness, and you can show us that you can take in more money and deliver nets, and you've done that in the past, like, you will get a lot of money. I mean, not you personally, but you can certainly use it to distribute bed nets. And we take this case to other organizations that are out there that distribute nets, and we basically say, like, we don't need you to prove that bed nets are effective. We just need you to show us that you need more money and that you have a track record of success. And if we saw that, they would win the prize. Yep, and back.
While you're doing the charity research, find opportunities for effective charities that don't exist yet? And if you do, how do you communicate them back to the community?
Yeah, so the question is whether we find opportunities for effective charities and what do we do about communicating that? So there's definitely like broad categories of effective charities that don't exist that I would like to see exist. It's a challenge to I think we have not yet communicated well about the specific types of opportunities we could see. But I think there are, I mean, the most obvious one, so just to sort of lay out like why this is challenging. So, the way our research process works is we assess the evidence for a program independent of a specific charity. So we might assess whether bed nets actually reduce malaria and save lives. Often that evidence comes from sources entirely independent of any individual organization. And then we apply that research to organizations that are actually implementing bed nets, and then that lowers the burden of proof on them. There are programs that we consider what we call priority programs that are sort of similarly cost effective to bed nets, but we don't have a charity that implements them. So things like there's some nuance around this, but basically, the distribution of vitamin A supplements, the provision of conditional cash transfers, implementation of immunization campaigns for tetanus. You know, these are programs that we've conducted literature reviews on, and we just haven't seen organizations that are implementing them. I think there is a big challenge associated with starting a charity of this type. It's not the type, you know, the sort of startup story you think about in the San Francisco Bay Area is like a person at their computer starting a company. And, you know, if you're trying to start a vitamin A supplementation organization in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is what I think would be necessary, that has a lot of challenges associated with it. And so it's not entirely clear that that's even something that is like realistic for someone to take on. But nonetheless, we'd like to do a better job communicating out to the world, you know, what types of organizations don't exist that we'd like to see exist. So I think that's actually a good segue into the sort of second set of things I want to talk about. And we'll have a little more time for questions after as well. This is a part of GiveWell's work we're calling, it doesn't really have a public name, but, you know, GiveWell Experimental. And the idea here is, we have struggled to find new outstanding giving opportunities. And so the question we're asking ourselves now is, you know, what, if anything, can we do to support the development of future GiveWell top charities? This is an activity that, we're still capacity constrained. It's sort of like an ongoing theme. And so we haven't put as much energy into this as we ideally would have. So we still see opportunities on the table here that we haven't taken. But we have done some. And so I'm just going to sort of talk through some of the specific things that we've undertaken. And often here I'm going to talk about, like, we've done something. Most of the time when I say we, what I mean is that GiveWell staff have done this research, we've investigated these opportunities, and then Good Ventures, which is the foundation with which we share this office space, has provided a grant to support the activities. One type of problem that we run into in finding new top charities is we find a program that seems strong in principle, but we often don't have the data from the specific organization to be confident that it's being run effectively or being run cost effectively. So I think a great example of this is this maternal and neonatal tetanus immunization campaign program that I mentioned. So in this program, health workers immunize all women of childbearing age, and they aim to immunize them 3 times over the course of a couple of years. And by immunizing them for tetanus, they prevent neonatal tetanus mortality. So deaths from tetanus among newborns, which remains a significant killer of children worldwide. As a whole, this program seems to have significant evidence of effectiveness. It's extremely cost effective. It would be as or more cost effective than our top charities, assuming that the initial coverage rate of immunizations for tetanus are low. So everyone is supposed to receive tetanus immunizations as part of the childhood immunization series. If people receive them and get the appropriate boosters, they don't need this additional campaign. If coverage is low when the campaign comes in, the program would be more cost effective. If coverage is already high, then it's unnecessary. And so that's sort of one piece of data we would need. The second is the baseline neonatal mortality rate, how many children are dying from this, because factors other than immunization affect tetanus mortality. For example, unhygienic hospitals are more susceptible to tetanus than very hygienic locations. So if neonatal tetanus mortality is lower for reasons other than this immunization campaign, the cost effectiveness of the program will be lower. And then finally, the effective coverage rate of the program. You know, are they actually able to reach people? When they reach people, are the vaccines still effective? Or for lack of refrigeration, have they lost their effectiveness? So these are the questions that we would have for a charity that was implementing this program. We still hope to investigate UNICEF, which implements this program. And we expect to talk to them about it eventually. But one challenge is that they may not have this data. And often in our experience, charities either don't or don't have it or won't share the data. And so one possibility is funding another group to go out and collect this data independent of the charity itself. And that could enable us to identify more top charities. And so what we've done to that end is there's a group called ID Insight. And it's a relatively small research group that works on global health evaluation and monitoring. And what we've provided funding to them to conduct monitoring of SCI's activities. So SCI is one of our top charities. They are the top charity that we've always had the most problems really understanding how effective their programs are, because the monitoring they've shared and the communication we've had haven't been as high quality as we've hoped, as we have had been with our other top charities. And so we funded ID Insight to work with them, both because we'd like more information about SCI's effectiveness, but also see this as something like a pilot project to see whether we're able to work with ID Insight and have a relationship where we can fund them to go out and collect the type of data that we would need to increase our confidence, or at least give us more information about a charity's activities and their effectiveness. So there's the short term SCI thing, and then hopefully the longer term vision of them being a partner who we can work with to collect data. Another type of so that's sort of on the monitoring side. Another type of activity we've undertaken is supporting the scale up of programs that have significant evidence already. So one example of this is a group called New Incentives. They're basically a startup organization. They provide conditional cash transfers. They work in Nigeria, and the condition is that it's available to pregnant mothers who are HIV positive. And the goal of the program is to get mothers to come into the clinics to take the AIDS treatment drugs that prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And so basically the participants collect part of their transfer each time they come to the clinic and take a pill. And this program, conditional cash transfers as a whole, is a program that has substantial evidence of effectiveness, and we have our report on that. And then preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV is something that we have not done our sort of full deep dive on, but I think it's fair to say that the evidence looks extremely promising, that this likely works and is cost-effective. So they started up one of the founders we felt was sort of aligned with us in terms of transparency and openness, and so Good Ventures and another funder provided them with a $100,000 grant to get started in Nigeria, and they've been working there for a year. We've been following their progress, and we're hopeful that down the line they become another GiveWell top charity. We actually haven't published much about them yet. Our sort of publication cycle is still lagging a little bit behind our actual activities, but we're planning to post more information about them soon. Another place we've worked on scale-up is a program that focuses on seasonal migration in Bangladesh. So this is a program where they give a small credit to poor individuals and encourage them to migrate from rural to urban Bangladesh during the famine season. So these are often farmers who, during the famine season, have very limited means for raising or earning money, and when they migrate to the city, at least in this trial, they earn significantly more. And so, this was a study conducted by a researcher, a randomized control trial in 2008, and they found that people did, in fact, earn significantly more after migration than they had before, and they even chose to migrate again in future seasons, even with the absence of the cash credit. So this was a program that was conducted. The research seemed really promising, but there wasn't any movement towards scaling this up to be implemented more widely. And so we funded Evidence Action, which is the parent of the Deworm the World initiative, to do two things. One, go back to Bangladesh and basically run the program again at roughly 10 times as large a scale as had been done in the original experiment. And so it went from 400 to 4,000 participants, I believe. And they're currently in the process of collecting data on that. If that goes well, the goal is that there'd be a seasonal migration opportunity to donate to at Evidence Action on the scale of our current top charities. There's a lot of questions that remain to be worked out there, but just like that's sort of the ideal. And then they also went to Zambia and Malawi and said, is this the type of program that could work in these other countries as well? What's really interesting is that at least in one of those, and I don't off the top of my head remember which, they found that the opportunities to migrate were just not as promising as they were in Bangladesh. And I think it's because the job opportunities available at the point to which people migrated were not nearly as high earning as they had been in Bangladesh. And so they wrote this long report detailing the process they went through and the ultimate finding that, you know, this program that looked very promising in one location just would not have been a good idea in this other location. It would have had no effect. And so, I, you know, that's a big report they published on their website, and I, you know, thought was really interesting. The final type of activity we're sort of involved in on this front is funding replications of research studies that have been conducted once. And so there was a study that was conducted by the Poverty Action Lab, which is a group that runs randomized controlled trials of development interventions to provide incentives to parents who brought their children to vaccination camps. So the children received their routine immunization, and they found that it for relatively low cost, increased the proportion of children who were fully immunized. This was a single RCT that was run, you know, 10 years ago, and there wasn't much movement towards scaling this up. And so we've been in conversations with the Poverty Action Lab about funding, some replications for this program. And I think that in this case, they were actually moving on these replications before we got involved. So this is not something that, you know, we caused to happen. But we're certainly looking at that closely and considering grants to support these trials. So that's sort of a summary of what we've done. I mean, the other things we're just trying to do is we're trying to also just create sort of a large prioritized list of all the programs that could be so much more cost effective than our top charities that they'd be worth doing additional research on or trying to scale up. That is sort of at its very early stages, but it's something that we hope to have because it's essential for this work to happen going forward. Longer term, I think this experimental part of GiveWell is going to become a bigger and bigger part of our work because, we certainly struggled to find new top charities, and it seems like some of the opportunities that we're seeing in this experimental part of GiveWell, seem really promising, certainly seem promising relative to the costs involved. And so, we anticipate this being a bigger part going forward. So I'm going to pause there again and open the floor for questions on this or anything else related to GiveWell. Right here.
Can you speak a bit about your priorities on, say, identifying charities with giving to versus expanding your capacity to identify charities with giving to?
So the sort of prioritization of capacity building versus like straight research.
Yeah.
We're currently putting more effort into capacity building than straight research, and we're definitely prioritizing the capacity building over research. And one very clear manifestation of that is that, you know, I spend a lot more time recruiting, managing, training, evaluating, and much less time conducting the investigations themselves. I think that definitely has the downside that, you know, we're doing less today than we would if we just stopped all the capacity building. But already now we're doing more than we would have had we made the choice to prioritize research 2 years ago. And so I think we're still in a place where the capacity building is diminishing our research capacity relative to our like current state. But we're hopeful that long term that will turn around. Also, a lot of the capacity building we're doing that is, you know, GiveWell and Open Philanthropy are part of like one organization right now. And the capacity building we're doing is shared by like both organizations. And I think the needs to bring more people on, the need to bring more people on is not just a function of more top charities research, but also an expectation of needing a lot more capacity for open philanthropy. Yeah, right here.
So I'm fairly new to GiveWell, so I don't quite understand, but like, what's your metric? Like you've said you do a lot of research it sounds like it. But what's the metric when you, at the end of the day, kind of have to make your decision? Like, all these programs you're talking about sound kind of the same. It's like lives saved per dollar in Africa. Can you give some sense of that? Like, what, like, maybe there's a great program out there that distributes books and has some incredibly long-term impact that you can't measure. How do you account for that?
Yeah, so the question is sort of like, what's the bottom line GiveWell metric for deciding between charities? So there's definitely no single number that everything resolves to. The conceptual metric is lives saved in, or improved per dollar invested, and we do our best to quantify that to the extent we can. But there's just an inordinate number of judgment calls that go into that type of calculation. Assumptions about the data itself. So with a deworming program, what proportion of children are infected in the countries that they're going into? We have limited data about something as concrete as that. But also fuzzier judgment calls, because it's not always lives saved per dollar. Sometimes it's lives improved per dollar. Deworming programs don't save lives. The best evidence is that they increase earnings 10 years after the program. And so you're trying to translate between lives improved and lives saved. That's clearly not something that is like a mathematical equation. What we try to do is so we have a file, we allow each staff member to put in their own philosophical values for translating between lives saved and improved. And that's one input into our process. Beyond that, there's other factors that I think can cause would cause an individual donor to adjust that figure one way or the other. So, how much confidence do you have that the organization and the people who run it are, competent or extremely effective? That is not quantifiable, but I think should end up playing some role. And so our approach to all of this is to try to quantify what we can, then try to articulate all the other factors that go into our final decision, but then lay it all out transparently so anyone who wants to and has a lot of time can go through it all and make a decision for themselves. Yep.
Piggybacking off what he said, can you give the example with the iodine charity? How does IQ and those preventing those birth defects, like how could you quantify that in terms of life improved or like, for example, just like, let's say 3% less birth defects, how does that actually relate to happiness?
Yeah, so good question. So the question is, how do we actually do this in the case of the iodine charities? How do we quantify things? I just want to put a big caveat on everything I'm about to say, which is, we're doing our best to quantify what we can, and there's just, in no way do I think this represents like everything that you could say about the impact per dollar of this program. And you can read a lot about this on our website if you want. But with iodine specifically, I think that there's like an average IQ effect that you can expect based on the trials of moving people from moderate iodine deficiency to iodine sufficiency. And then we looked at studies that correlated IQ with income and use that to come up with like a basic way of translating an IQ gain into an income gain. And that, is something we can then compare to two of our other groups of top charities, GiveDirectly, which has cash transfers, and the main benefit there is increased income, and Deworming, where the main benefit is also increased income. Translating between income and lives saved is basically that crazy philosophical judgment call that I think you sort of basically need to make on your own. Yep.
I noticed some good positive press of GiveWell recently in like popular blogs and news sites. Have you seen any impact of that coverage on your Money Moved?
Yeah, so the question is impact of recent media on Money Moved. So far Money Moved this year has grown, let me put it this way. A lot of the way we see the effect of media is that it often takes a while for the like full effect to carry through. And the reason for this is that most of the money that we move comes from a relatively small proportion of our overall donor base. So, something like, I can't give you the numbers off the top of my head, but the kind of classic 80-20 principle applies where, 80% of the funding comes from 20% of the donors. And in charity, I think it's even more top heavy. Something like Good Ventures accounted for one donor accounted for 50% of our money moved last year. Because it's so top heavy, I think what happens, that means that the decisions of relatively few individuals drive the overall change in how much money we're moving. And the largest donors tend to take more time to make decisions about how much they give. So, you know, the donor who's going to give $1 million is not going to like read about us in, or I think, I have not yet seen a donor who, well, we've seen some crazy things, which I'm happy to tell you about, but, you know, read about us in The Atlantic or in Vox and just decide to write a $1 million check. You know, they're much more likely to take their time and give after a year or two of following us closely, maybe even give a significantly smaller gift at first that's followed on by more in later years. So, you know, when I think back to something like Peter Singer's book, The Life You Can Save, which came out in 2009, you know, we saw, and we see this year, like a short-term spike in web traffic, in small donations, and we see all that happening now. But I think the biggest effects of Peter Singer's book are, we're still feeling them now when a new donor who's giving $1 million tells us that he or she heard about us from reading Peter Singer's book. And that is the type of effect that I expect more, both from, you know, the media that's come out and sort of the online media, and also the effective altruism-oriented books, you know, Peter Singer's book that has come out, and other books that are coming out this year, that in many ways is like a longer-term process for that to like flow all the way through. But I definitely believe there's a pretty strong connection between being out there in the media and donations ultimately coming through. That's certainly what we've seen historically.
Can you talk about any changes you've seen with regard to the way other charities have presented themselves, or other people have talked about how to donate to charities, or anything other of that sort?
So any change in how charities represent themselves, or people talk about donating to charity? And there's definitely more discussion in the popular media of you know, effective altruism specifically than I think there's been in the past. There's been, since GiveWell started in 2007, there's always a sort of a part of the nonprofit sector, a part of media that's interested in, you know, better metrics for charity. Often, you know, when we first started, we were more aligned with that group in our way of thinking. And I think though it didn't seem to have, or I didn't see direct connection between like talking more about better metrics and organizations that like we were confident in recommending, I think a lot of the media now is more focused on the types of questions that we ask. And I think that's a function of the growing of this effective altruism community, and it's just, it's becoming a bigger deal. I don't think we've really seen a change in how charities present themselves and the data they collect. The biggest change we've seen is that as GiveWell's influence has grown and the potential funding we can offer has grown, charities are much more willing to engage with us than they were when we first began. So, I mean, anyhow, we could have lots of story time about what it was like when GiveWell had no funding to offer. But now, if there's a, you know, a big charity that we want to talk to, like, we'll be able to talk to them. We'll be able to get an answer about whether they'll apply or not. Some still choose not to participate, but we are not worried that groups are ignoring us just because the incentive is not there. And it's gotten significantly easier for us to, you know, do the research we do. Yeah, right here.
How do you think GiveWell's process would notice if they were starting to hit diminishing returns in one of their like top charities?
So is the question about diminishing returns on the research we're doing, or like diminishing returns, like the charities getting diminishing returns on the money they receive?
I was thinking that, what the charity's doing mostly,
uh-huh.
But I'm also curious in the answers to the other two questions.
Sure. So how would we notice if charities were hitting diminishing returns with their work, where money was like no longer having the same effect it was having in the past? Is that basically the
question?
I mean, this is just something that like we're you know, trying to be as focused on as we can. So we're following up. You know, one of the types of work we do is follow up with the charities we've moved significant amounts of funding to. We follow them and we look for times when they no longer seem to be having the type of impact that they've had in the past. You know, the main way this manifests is we push charities as we're reviewing them. And part of now reviewing a charity is this update process for a group that's been on our list for a few years. And we ask them, you know, how much additional funding can you use? What would you use it for? And then the following year, we hold them accountable to the plan they laid out. And when we see divergences, that raises questions that we can ask them about, you know, whether they're still able to operate at the same level they've operated in the past. So I think it's difficult to know, but we're certainly, you know, focused on this question, and our ongoing investigations tries to, you know, address it. Yep, right here.
So following up on the question, like how much churn have you seen in your charities over the years?
So the question is, how much churn have we seen in our charities over the years? So from the very earliest days, you know, there's been a lot of churn. So, you know, if you look, we archive our top charities page. If you look at what we recommended in 2007, 2008, 2009, it's very different than what it is today. I think that our top charities basically reached its sort of a mature state where we were no longer figuring out how to do the work, but just like executing on a basic framework somewhere in 2011 or 2012. And since then, there's been relatively limited churn among our top charities. We added GiveDirectly in 2012. We added Deworm the World in 2013. We took down the Against Malaria Foundation in 2013 because we didn't think they had a good use of marginal funds at that point. Now they're back. And we added some standout charities last year. But by and large, the last few years have seen relatively little churn. But I mean, we certainly don't, you know, taking down AMF and in previous years taking down, I mean, this is sort of ancient history, but Village Reach was an organization that we recommended from 2009 until 2011, I believe. And, you know, at the time we were like real, GiveWell was associated with like Village Reach as its recommendation. And we just did not hesitate to take them down when we felt like they didn't have additional room for more funding or the giving opportunity wasn't as high quality anymore. And so it's just not something we would hesitate to do right now if we found an opportunity that was, you know, either the opportunities we had no longer seemed good enough or we found opportunities that were significantly better. Yep.
Following off her question, how do you evaluate yourselves when it comes to figuring out how you're affecting charities and whether or not your research is having the impact you intend?
Yeah, so like how does GiveWell evaluate itself? So basically, like there's two main inputs to GiveWell's effectiveness. It's how good are the opportunities we're recommending relative to where people would have otherwise given? And then how much money do we influence overall? The first part of that is, you know, how good are the opportunities we have relative to the average or where people would have otherwise given? I mean, it's just basically impossible to assess in any confident way. I mean, I think that our charities are better by a significant factor, but it's really hard to know. I mean, we do survey donors about, you know, what they say they would have done in GiveWell's absence. I think the most common answers are that they would have given a lot less or they would have given to other international aid organizations. That's all in our annual metrics report. But anyhow, that's a hard one to answer. The amount of money we influence is something we can track, we do track, and we work very hard to do so. So we encourage people to tell us if they gave, if you gave to our top charities and you haven't told us, please tell us, because that's an important part of our assessing our own impact. And so last year, like I said, about $20 million went to our top charities. That's a number that has grown substantially in the years that GiveWell has been in existence. And certainly that's a major part of you know, our impact. All right, I'm going to take one more question. Yeah, right here.
So why is not the Gates Foundation involved as heavily as Good Ventures?
Why is the Gates Foundation not as involved with GiveWell?
Yeah.
I mean, I think
there's a lot of money there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, funders have different priorities. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that the Gates Foundation does that, you know, I think is not as effective as GiveWell's top charities and, you know, I think, or not as cost effective. And I think, you know, some of that is funding U.S. social programs, which we looked at in our first years and, you know, it just don't seem like you get the same bang for your buck in the U.S. as you get internationally. You know, I think other things that the Gates Foundation does, it's more debatable how it compares to GiveWell's top charities. So funding scientific research into diseases that affect the developing world. You know, I think there's a case that you can make that these opportunities are neglected because for diseases that affect the rich world, we're rich and we're going to pay for medical treatment. But diseases that affect the poor world, it's a market failure and no one is there to pay. And so the Gates Foundation, you know, can, by funding that, they may be filling a gap. And that certainly like could be competitive with GiveWell's top charities or even better than. And so I think to some extent, you know, what the Gates Foundation, some of the opportunities they're pursuing are like, you know, potentially as cost effective or better than GiveWell's top charities.
I guess what I was wondering is, are you engaging with the Gates Foundation? You're trying to convince them that, you know, to get some of that money.
So are we like trying to engage with the Gates Foundation? I mean, I think that we're not, and I don't think we'd be successful at, you know, that. I mean, I think that they, most funders, especially funders who I think are as thoughtful as Gates is, but also just in general, funders come in with their priorities and you know, tend to want to work within those priorities. And I don't think we would be successful at convincing the Gates Foundation to allocate money to GiveWell's top charities. And we could talk more about the specifics of, you know, their interests as I perceive them and how they do and don't overlap with our top charities, but I don't think that would really work. You know, Good Ventures is really a unique case where we met Carrie and Dustin when they were just at the beginning of thinking about how to give, and they are extremely values aligned with us in thinking about, you know, what opportunities seem like they'll be the most impactful. And so that's created a partnership that, you know, I don't think we'd be likely to repeat with existing funders. You know, one hope we have for the future is that there'll be other donors who have a similar mindset to what Carrie and Dustin had when they were starting Good Ventures. You know, maybe the next big company that, you know, other big tech entrepreneurs. And certainly we're like hopeful that long-term, you know, though that group of foundations wants to sort of join up and give to the things that we're working on or other similarly impactful activities. So I want to wrap up to give everyone a break before the open philanthropy session. But, you know, thank you all for coming and for your questions. I really appreciate it. So feel free to use the rest.